Welcome to the fourth part of the Eightfold Path. We're coming up on halfway done. And we're halfway through the section of the path on ethics. There's speech, which we did last month. This is action. And next month will be livelihood. So the usual word for this section of the path is ethics. It's been suggested that a word that's a little easier for people to work with is integrity, to be whole and integrated, so that all of the parts of our being are connected, working together. Acts that are driven by hate, greed, or delusion to the point of theft or violence or sexual abuse threaten the sense of wholeness and integration of every being who is affected by those actions. A fracture of that integration has an impact on the lives of the victims, as well as the cohesion of the society, as well as the perpetrator's integrity and relationship to all other beings. We're all interconnected, and we cannot follow this path just for ourselves. It must be for the benefit of all. What we are and do affects many others for good or ill in ways that we may never know. All Buddhist teachings are meant to protect the connections within us and throughout society. So our central concern in practicing wise action is the intention not to harm or ending dukkha for ourselves and for others. Now, just so we understand the possibility of our causing dukkha for others, let's just quickly review the fact that dukkha is an internal phenomenon. It is not inherent in external conditions, but in our reaction to them. The second noble truth tells us that dukkha is caused by clinging, which is either craving or aversion. We're either wanting something that doesn't exist, it's not true in the current moment, or there's something that is true that we want to push away. We don't like it. Either of those are clinging to what we want other than the truth of the moment. And that causes stress, distress, Joseph Goldstein says that it's like clinging to a rope that's being pulled through our hands. We get rope burn from it. That's what dukkha is like. So dukkha is something that we each do to ourselves. And all humans who aren't fully enlightened have dukkha. So we need to meet it with compassion, both our own and the dukkha of others. The end of dukkha is letting go of that rope, and eventually letting go to the point of nirvana, where all of the things within us that cause us to cling have been eliminated. Now, we all know that there are situations that create the causes and conditions where people are likely to cling and suffer, have dukkha. Safety is key for all animals. Feeling threatened with harm is serious dukkha. Crime statistics, the news, and our own experiences make it normal for people, and especially women, to feel threatened in many situations. If persistent, fear can destabilize any sentient being. So wise action is usually phrased as prohibitions against acts that are pretty much guaranteed to cause dukkha. Not directly, but cause the conditions in someone to cling and to suffer. And these acts are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Physical attacks leave psychic scars, and serious physical injury will reduce the quality of life. Losing someone to murder is traumatic for the survivors. And the social fabric is torn by the loss of that person in their connections with their job, family, friends, organizations that they belong to, etc., etc. We may never know how far it ripples out. Sexual violence has an added dimension of trauma because it attacks the person's dignity and can harm their future comfort with sexuality. A very complex and sometimes delicate, very deep way that we connect with other beings. Having things stolen attacks people's sense of security and can feel like an invasion. I've had several friends whose homes have been burglarized, and it's difficult for them to walk into their homes afterwards. And it can feel like an assault, just having your purse taken when you set it down, or other possessions that you know have someone has intentionally deprived you of. And then there's the cost of replacing whatever's been stolen. Or having to go without it if you can't afford to replace it. This part of the path and the precepts all help beings feel safer. It stabilizes societies. The more there is wise action among us, the better off we all are. So we can approach wise action as the kind of prohibitive non-harming, or the kind of positive aspect of kindness. If we have metta for all, we automatically don't want to harm anyone or any animal. The Buddha said that after stream entry, which is the first stage of enlightenment, we're incapable of breaking the precepts. Harming any being just has no appeal. But in the meantime, it's often easier to recognize when behaviors are likely to injure or deprive someone of things they need, or sexual misconduct, than it is for us to ponder and decide in every instance how to be compassionate, generous, and respectful. In fact, I recently posed the idea of wise action in terms of kindness, and it left at least one person feeling overwhelmed. What is the boundaries of all of my actions being kind? So if we avoid, carefully, thoughtfully avoid physically harming, depriving people of things they need or are entitled to, and misusing, abusing sexual energy, then we will certainly be acting with more kindness. So in wise action, what we're doing is carefully avoiding creating conditions known to cause dukkha. And these actions powerfully affect victims and their communities. But the principle, even if we're looking at it that way, is still to care about all beings so that we don't set them up for dukkha. For example, I'm sure there are people that you know where their buttons are, but don't push them. Especially not with the intention of making them suffer. That's what we're talking about here. Intentionally inflicting suffering of a psychic nature. The intention to do that, the intention to harm, is totally contrary to the condition of the heart that the path leads to. And acting on that harmful intention inclines us further away from liberation. Now, looking around in this room and seeing all these faces, and I know it's very unlikely anyone here or anyone listening or viewing this talk is going to want to murder a human being, or pull a heist, or rape someone. The value then for us is in grappling with lesser versions of these modes of harming. And I also want to emphasize that understanding intellectually what it is that I say or anything you read about wise action doesn't have as much benefit for you as practicing with it, such as with working with the exercises that are on that handout over on the table next to the Donna basket. These are not intellectual teachings, nor is anything in Buddhism. All visceral, which need to be felt to be truly understood. So it's terrific when we do not feel sure what to do in these areas of our possible actions. Exploring and struggling with it is the best way for us to learn. Examining an uneasy conscience, though, is only good for purposes of understanding our current intention. Our purpose is not to inflame any sense of guilt that we may already have, but just to learn what might strengthen our sense of integrity going forward. So I just want to review both the traditional and the more contemporary teachings on killing, theft, and sexual misconduct. Killing in Pali, the term that appears in the suttas, is panatipata, which means both attack and to injure. Now, it's really interesting to me that you've probably all heard of the crimes of assault and battery. And in the law, assault is just acting as if you're going to injure someone, putting them in fear of imminent physical injury. And battery is, you've done it. They're injured. Or you've at least done your best to cause an injury. So panatipata is something that is not good to do with any conscious breathing being, so any live animal, including pests. Panatipata also prohibits slaughtering animals for food. The monks were forbidden to allow others to kill specifically for the monks to eat. So they say, I'm going to go slaughter a chicken and cook it for you. No, don't do that. But what does this mean for us when our food comes from a grocery store? I don't have an answer, but maybe you do, for you. An answer that works for you and your sense of integrity. Some contemporary teachers broaden panatipata to include any violence, a slap or a grab or a shove. But my lawyer mind wants to know, what about people in a fit of rage who destroy property, and that causes the fear of injury? Again, no answer from here, just from your own heart. So theft, take, borrow, or use things belonging to others without their permission. Now, I studied the Inuit culture when I was in graduate school, and that's, you know, in the Arctic, where tools were precious, just invaluable. They were so hard to make, to design. You took a long time to learn how to make them. And everybody needed them. Life depends on those tools. But you can't use all your tools at once. So in that culture, it's okay to borrow, without specific permission, someone else's tools if you actually know that they're not going to be using them for the time that you have them. Because it's a generous culture. So the rules can be tightened or loosened depending on the connections between people. Now, I am fastidious about this rule, but I just went through a month with this right action practice with other students. And in the course of doing that, you know, on reflection, I realized that I do use apps or computer programs that I haven't paid for. So it is invaluable to examine any justifications that we have for breaking these rules and seeing if we can find what views lie under those justifications, such as really not liking the company that makes those programs, finding their marketing techniques pretty hard on the consumer. Moving on to sexuality. Most of the traditional teachings in Buddhism come from the Buddhas talking to the monks who are celibate. But also the Buddha taught that great care should be taken to protect marriage and the spouses from the dukkha that is often caused by adultery or other forms of cheating. Many people now use this as covering partners that are in committed relationships, whether or not they're legally married. And social norms are now accepting sex in dating. Although I know quite well that it's very challenging to know what will cause dukkha to self and others in temporary relationships. I have known over the years a number of people who are polyamorous, and within the group of people they know who practice polyamory, there are a lot of rules. And single dating often doesn't have those rules, at least not expressly. And that may help. The Buddha warned against indulging in sexual fantasies because they can set us up to be more subject to impulses to go against what we feel is in keeping with our sense of integrity. In other words, it weakens our resistance to impulses to act unwisely. Currently, society is going through a period when it's recognizing a lot of conduct that was not previously clearly defined as sexual abuse. Even though the victims knew all along what sexual misconduct was, there is now a lot of learning that people are doing about how to avoid harming someone through the abuse of sexual energy. So the value in non-harming is that it reduces dukkha from clinging and from greed, hatred, and delusion. It relieves us of the reasons for having a painful conscience. In other words, the bliss of blamelessness, it's called. To live without any remorse or the disapproval of others or fear of other consequences. A commitment to not harming sets the mind at ease and makes it well suited for mindfulness practice and living on the Eightfold Path. And it keeps our impulses in check until our metta grows strong enough to eliminate the potentially harmful ones. Now, I'm going over my half hour for the talk. That's to be expected on these Eightfold Path Dharma talks. But I want to take a few minutes to invite you to reflect to yourself on four questions that I'm going to ask. So take a deep breath. Bring your attention back into the body, in touch with your feelings. In what situations do you feel you could kill or physically harm sentient beings without compromising your sense of integrity? In what situations do you feel you could take something not freely offered by others without compromising your sense of integrity? In what situations do you feel you could indulge in sexual misconduct without compromising your sense of integrity? And finally, if you don't always act according to these intentions, why not? So these questions are not intended to make you feel guilty or start a group confession. I just wanted us all really to take a look at how day-to-day conduct may reflect intentions we're not entirely comfortable with. And this is the case with almost everyone. It may be that the greatest value of practicing with ethics or integrity is studying our feelings and the motives behind our actions. Going deeper and deeper, developing ever greater mindfulness and self-knowledge, and strengthening the wise intention of ending dukkha. May we all abide in metta, compassion, and the bliss of blamelessness.